You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Hubble of the Open Society Fellowship Program. On behalf of the Open Society Foundations and our friends at the Brennan Center, we are delighted to welcome you to this discussion of Engines of Liberty, the Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. When David Cole approached us in the waning days of 2011 with an idea for a fellowship project on the subject of what he was provisionally calling civic constitutionalism, the timing did not strike us as particularly auspicious. Citizens United had been decided the previous year. A raft of other cases relevant to campaign finance were making their way up through the appellate system, certain to run into the same 5-4 majority that gave us Citizens United. Meanwhile, after a series of encouraging victories, advocates for marriage equality had suffered several stinging defeats, chiefly in the form of ballot referendums that were enshrining traditional marriage. And for a while, it seemed as if the promise of marriage equality was more remote than ever. At the same time, in another sphere, the U.S. government was escalating its use of drone warfare in places like Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, and elsewhere. That previous year, an American citizen had actually been assassinated using a drone in Yemen. Meanwhile, the bulk collection of telephone metadata was accelerating. What has happened, what has transpired in the intervening years has been nothing short of breathtaking, culminating in a landmark decision on marriage equality in 2015, new constraints on executive action in the so-called war on terror, and renewed hope even in the area of campaign finance reform, as Wendy Weiser and I were discussing just before this event. It is testament to David Cole's perspicacity, his vision, that he saw the early evidence that some of these breakthroughs were possible well before the rest of us did, and that the crucial ingredient of citizen action could make the difference that we sought. We are deeply proud here at the Open Society Foundations to have played a small role in the birth and maturation of this book. It is a role that will grow with each subsequent retelling, believe me, David, because we're very proud of this book. And I know I speak for many in this room when I say that during these past event-filled years, I would turn regularly and eagerly to the pages of The New Yorker, where in search of insight from their staff writer, Jeffrey Toobin, who is our moderator today. Jeffrey is the best-selling author of The Nine, Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, and The Run of His Life. He has written and commented on many of the most controversial cases of our time, including those involving Michael Jackson, O.J. Simpson, Bill Clinton. His New Yorker obituary of Justice Scalia, called Looking Back, was one of the best commentaries written on that topic, at least by my lights. He is a staff writer at The New Yorker and senior legal analyst at CNN, and we're delighted to have him here today. Thank you very much, and over to you, Jeff. I was going to introduce you, but I'm happy to.
Why don't you introduce Wendy too, so we're like I can just start writing because I don't have the full Wendy resume at my fingertips here, and we have could go on a long time.
It could go on a very long time. Wendy, I don't have the word. I couldn't carry all those papers down with the full Wendy resume. So I know that Wendy works on campaign finance at the Brennan Center. There's a lot more to say about you.
Director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, including campaign finance reform, voting, redistricting, fair courts, and I am delighted to be here.
Thank you very much.
That's what we hired him for these insightful questions.
No, I am seriously. It's like we're here to listen to you, not to me.
So put your mic on. That's the first thing I'll say. Push it, and when it's a red light, there you go.
God, it's so high tech.
So, well, thank you for that question, Jeff.
Well,
And thank you to OSF, which really did get me rolling on this book when I was an OSF fellow, and not just by supporting me in writing it, but also by the many conversations that I had with people here and in Washington who have devoted their careers to trying to change society for the better through support of civil society. So thank you to them. Thank you to Wendy and the Brennan Center, who are co-sponsors here. The Brennan Center is a brilliant example of the kind of civil society work that I'm talking about can make such a difference, much of it outside of the courts. And then thank you to all the people who came. There are some seats in the front. We won't call on you, and you can leave early even if you sit in the front. But I have former students, former colleagues at the Center for Constitutional Rights and here at OSF, former clients, law school friends. So, the only people that are not here are my wife and kids. But otherwise, pretty much everyone I know is here. So thank you. So the book is really about the democratic roots of constitutional change. It's an argument that, when we talk about the Constitution and constitutional law, we talk incessantly about the court and about the five justices who hold the power to change the Constitution through their interpretations. And sometimes we talk about the arguments made before the court and the lawyers who appear before the court and the cases. My sense was that that's a really an incomplete picture of how constitutional law develops and evolves in this country. And, of course, it has developed and evolved dramatically from the time that some dead old white men signed off on it on our behalf and today. And so I looked at the three most successful constitutional reform campaigns of my professional lifetime, and I think of pretty much everybody here. How did marriage equality go from unthinkable to inevitable? It was unthinkable in 1972, actually, when a gay couple petitioned the Supreme Court and said, "We have a right to marry on the same terms as heterosexual couples," and the Supreme Court dismissed it with a single sentence in 1972. Saying it doesn't even present a serious federal question, we're not even going to take up the case. To 2015, when we were waiting for the court to decide, and it was inevitable that they were going to recognize marriage equality. How did that happen? The court in 1972 was more liberal than the court in 2015. The arguments were the same. The court didn't change constitutional law. It recognized that constitutional law had changed. So how did that happen? How did it change? And then the second one is how did the individual right to bear arms go from something that was for 100 years rejected as a constitutional doctrine? Chief Justice Warnberger said it was, he said in 1991, he said, the notion that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms is the greatest fraud perpetrated on the American people by a special interest organization in my lifetime. And within 20 years, the Supreme Court had declared that it was not only not a fraud, but it was a constitutional right. And that special interest group, in my view, the single most effective civil liberties organization in the United States, the NRA, is responsible, I argue, for that shift. And even today, after the court decided the Second Amendment protects the individual right to bear arms, it's that group rather than the court that is the real protector of our liberties. And the third story is what caused President Bush, by the time he ended his term in office, to curtail so many of his counterterrorism measures. By the time he left, he had released over 500 people from Guantanamo. He had suspended the CIA's torture interrogation program. He had emptied out the CIA's secret prisons. He had suspended extraordinary rendition when we take people in country A and deliver them to Morocco or Egypt or Syria so they can torture them for us. He had put the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program, which he created unilaterally under judicial supervision. How did that happen, given that in prior periods of crisis and wartime, presidents had gotten to do whatever they deemed necessary in dealing with the enemy? And again, my argument is that it's really civil society. It's us. So, you know, I call it the engines of liberty, the power of citizen activists to make constitutional law. If someone hadn't already stolen this title, I would have called it the power of citizens united to make constitutional law, because it's really about groups, it's about organizations, it's about the power of the civil society sector to really effectuate change.
So there is a conceit underlying legal education, which is that courts decide what the Constitution is, and that, you know, we you referred to it at the beginning of your remarks, that the Supreme Court or and other courts recognize what the Constitution means, and you are asserting in the book that it's not just the courts. But does this mean that constitutional law is just politics, and that elections right. are going to determine just what the Constitution means, and that there is essentially no core there?
Right. So great question. So I always thought the conceit underlying legal education was the law professors. You identify a see he opens with a really easy question and then he and
see
follows
we're,
up
we're
with
moving
a really hard
in and
question,
out. That's what we're doing.
Which is this, you know, if it's all politics, if that's the message of this book, then, you know, why do we have a constitution? And I, you know, I'm a believer. I quote Learned Hand in the book, who said, and this is sort of along the lines of Jeff's question. He said, "Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no court, no constitution, no law can save it. While it lies there, it needs no constitution, no court, no law to save it." In other words, it is all about us. And, you know, like many great quotes, this is an overstatement. I think we do need courts. We do need a constitution. And it is important to have a bulwark against sort of the vicissitudes of ordinary politics. And the Constitution plays a very important role in doing that. So how do I reconcile that? So my sense is that when you read these accounts, what you see is that these changes don't happen overnight. It's not like a bill gets enacted. There is a extended deliberative process that occurs in multiple forums, in state courts, in state legislatures, in even in foreign countries when it comes to human rights and executive power in the war on terror, in the academy. The NRA was very good about funding research that ultimately supported its view. And all of that then over time, if it is successful in transforming what we as a culture see as our fundamental values, then I think, and only then, is the court likely to recognize that constitutional law has changed. So it doesn't change because, you know, a bunch of people go march on the court and the next day, or they take a poll and the next day they change it. It requires this kind of what I would call constitutional politics, incremental change. And that's how it should be.
Now, your book is mostly descriptive. And, you know, you have the great liberal project of marriage equality and the great conservative project of an individual Second Amendment right. And then, which is mostly the mostly liberal, you know, constraint on military or intelligence activities in the third part. Is this good or bad? Is it good that we have this check, or is it good that citizens can do this? Is it bad, or is it just a fact that we have to deal with in the world?
So I think it's good. You know, it is mostly a descriptive book, but in terms of, I'm not arguing the merits of marriage equality or the individual right to bear arms or human rights in the war on terror. I'm really looking at trying to understand how change happens. What are the tactics that people deployed? And so that is my focus. But there is a normative sense in this sense. So it is in a way a response to the kind of originalism position that the Justice Scalia rest his soul position that we should just be bound by what they agreed to. And if we don't like it, we should change it through the constitutional amendment process, which happens to be impossible. My sense is that we are bound by the Constitution because it reflects who we are in our deepest commitments today, not because those white men with property who were allowed to vote and didn't even represent the majority at the time agreed to it, and not because whatever their views are. So constitutional law, I think, in order for it to work as a normatively legitimate institution in a democracy, has to reflect the development of society. And that development has these deeply democratic roots. And that's a good thing, because we wouldn't want to live in a society, I don't think, a democratic society where people have their cell phones on. But no, we wouldn't want to live in a democratic society where five justices just got to impose their views on us. Right? That's crazy. And whenever, you know, someone doesn't like a Supreme Court decision, like Justice Scalia didn't like the marriage equality decision, he portrays it as five justices just imposing their will on the people. Well, that is problematic. But I don't think that's actually what happens. I think what happens is we organically develop through democratic deliberation and debate in a variety of different forums. And only once that, when that development has kind of crystallized, is it possible to take an argument that was rejected as frivolous 40 years ago or a fraud 20 years ago, and it's recognized as a right.
So Wendy, you're the head of the Democracy Project at the Brennan Center. You are dealing in a very practical way with the legacy of Citizens United, with the legacy of Shelby County. When you think about litigating in this area, obviously you are thinking about how to write an excellent brief, how to call the right witnesses in court. Are you also thinking about the broader agenda that Dave lays out in the book?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to, for those of you who haven't read it, I commend this book. I think it's an incredible contribution to the thinking about how constitutional change happens. I agree that too frequently we have been so narrowly focused on the courts and the arguments made before the courts that people aren't seeing the broader context of what's really happening and how we are evolving our law. And certainly those of us who are in the business of law reform and in the civil society sector, need to use all of these tools in order to actually help persuade ultimately the five justices at the end of the day, whether it be political organizing, whether it be broad communications campaigns, scholarship, in all of the different ways that were described here. For example, in the Citizens United context, one of the central projects that we had to contend with in the money and politics field was there wasn't a unified scholarship rejecting the Supreme Court's approach to money and politics, and which was going to be a big challenge, even if there's broad popular opposition to the court's jurisprudence, to the Citizens United decision, if there isn't really any academic consensus around alternatives, then we're not going to be able to see a change in the courts. This is a real parallel to the Second Amendment story that you told. That has been something that, for example, the Brennan Center has worked over a number of years to try to foster, pulling together symposia to get people to start writing and thinking about what are alternatives to the court's approach in Citizens United. So that's sort of one example of the sort of many ways in which we sort of try to take all these pieces and put them together in our strategy to change the law.
I mean, in many ways, the Citizens United challenge is a greater challenge than gay marriage or gun rights, because one of the things that I show in the book is that the principal way I think that the gay rights groups and the gun rights groups advanced the ball when federal law was against them was by going to the states and filing lawsuits in state court, making state-based arguments, amending laws in sort of incremental ways to prepare the ground under state law to ultimately recognize their right, whether it's an individual right to bear arms or marriage equality. And that They could start in the states that were most sympathetic. They could develop those. They could then go to the next most sympathetic, build momentum, and then you can, you know, finally jump the tracks. But when a constitutional right has been recognized by the court against you, right, whether it be Citizens United if you're into campaign finance reform or Roe versus Wade if you're pro-life, it limits significantly what you can do.
It does. And in fact, there's been a lot more that we could do than you would otherwise think. But a real major difference, I think, between the three stories you tell and the situation that we're in money and politics, is these were all battles to try to recognize or expand a previously recognized right. In Citizens United, the script has been flipped, where the court has recognized the right to unlimited spending in elections, essentially. And so we need to, and has recognized only a very narrow legitimate interest on the other side, hasn't characterized that in rights terms. And so it's sort of starting in a different place there. There are some major advantages, though, relative to where the other movements were at this point before the courts. For example, there is widespread disapproval of the court's jurisprudence in Citizens United and in the entire money and politics realm to an extent that wasn't present in any of these other cases. I mean, it's really dramatic. And so I think that there are both advantages and disadvantages.
One reason why I think your book is so topical is that there are two big news events that I think are relevant to the ideas. One is the nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, and the other is the presidential campaign, where, in part because of the Garland nomination, the court is more of a topic for the candidates than it usually is. One of the things you now see with, let's talk about the Garland nomination first, is that you have particularly some Republican senators saying, you know, because of a vote that he cast about the Second Amendment, and it's a pretty it's like whether he voted to rehear a case on bank, it's hardly, you know, an opinion that he wrote. But putting aside the issue of, you know, what he actually did in that case, you have senators saying, well, you know, I am not going to vote for this candidate because of a specific vote on a specific issue. Isn't that okay by your standards? Because these senators are part of the constitutional conversation. They are expressing their view of the Second Amendment, and they are voting or not voting accordingly.
So I do think that one of the ways in which the constitutional change in the political realm and in society at large gets translated into constitutional law written by the court is through the nominations process. So, you know, if, for example, the NRA was opposed to the filing of the case that eventually recognized the right to bear arms because they felt, much as the gay rights groups did with respect to the first case filed in federal court urging recognition of marriage equality after Proposition 8, that it was too early. It was too early to go to the court, and they were nervous. They didn't think they necessarily had five votes, and they probably didn't. They had reason to believe that Justice O'Connor would not recognize the right. And so they fought hard to get that case killed, and they failed. It was filed. You can't, one of the lessons is you can't actually, as much as we would like to control national litigation strategies, and the gay rights groups did a pretty good job, the NRA does a tremendous job, but nonetheless, you can't control
it. But, I mean, it is interesting that both cases, both the Proposition 8 case, which was the lawyers were David Boies and Ted Olson, who were not part of the gay rights litigation cabal, and the Heller case in coming out of D.C. was not part of the NRA litigation cabal. Both of them went forward anyway,
but then what the NRA did was once it was going forward, it went full steam ahead, you know, and it played a critical role in the election of George W. Bush both times. It was I think in 2000 his single biggest civil society supporter was the NRA, and then when it came time for George Bush to replace Justice O'Connor and Chief Justice Rehnquist, they picked two justices who were very friendly to gun rights, and they ended up winning the case. And the case wasn't decided until Justices Roberts and Alito were sitting on the court, and they won 5-4. So that's a situation in which it does make a difference. And you know, I think one of the reasons that we have a system in which the president nominates and the Senate confirms is because there's a recognition that these people have power, and so their views are relevant. And I don't know what is it appropriate or not for a particular senator to take a single issue and say, I'm not going to vote for this person if he's not pro-gun rights, or I'm not going to vote for this person if he's not pro-choice. I don't think I would want that to be the norm, and I don't think litmus tests are particularly appropriate. But it's a political it's an avowedly political process. There is nothing in the Constitution that says senators must look at the justice as a whole, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I mean, litmus test, that brings me to the next question. Yeah. Because litmus test, there used to be a really strong stigma in among presidential candidates to say that, well, I don't have a litmus test about Roe v. Wade, but any justice I nominate would almost certainly uphold Roe v. Wade or oppose Roe v. Wade, as the case may be. In the 2016 campaign, it is not... I mean, there's been a lot. It hasn't been focused on a lot. But one thing I've certainly noticed is that both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have said, I will only appoint justices who will vote to uphold Roe v. Wade and overturn Citizens United. Now, what does that do to the process? Yeah. So if with their interviewing potential candidates, is it appropriate to ask them, you know, Judge so-and-so, will you vote to overturn Roe v. Wade? I mean, have litmus tests moved to the realm of the acceptable, and should they be acceptable?
Yeah, well, I think they obviously moved to the realm of the acceptable if major presidential candidates right.
Donald Trump has not expressed a view on this just yet. He's not so much about the Supreme Court.
You have to be in favor of the constitutionality of the Donald. And that's the litmus test. But... that disturbs me. I do think, you know, but I think it's a, but it points to this very tension. Right?
Yes.
But what, in a way, when you reduce an appointment to a single issue, that seems wrongheaded in that the court decides a whole range of issues, and you know we don't want to be deciding on a single for that reason. We don't want to be deciding on a single issue. But the inescapably political nature of the process is inescapable. We can argue about why it would be better to look at qualifications, look at worldview. More broadly, look at life experience. All of that is relevant. You can ask the question, but it's still also entirely appropriate for judges, and not only appropriate, but de rigueur for the nominee not to answer those questions. Right. So at the same time as we recognize that it's politically acceptable to ask the question, it's also politically acceptable for nominees not to answer the question.
Wendy.
And I think necessary. I mean, I think that's sort of the critical distinction here, that the judiciary, you know, needs to remain independent. The political branches are the political check on the process and can apply whatever assessment they want for a candidate and for choosing who they want to have on the bench. This isn't actually the only time in history where the selection of judges has focused on a narrow set of issues. We think of the New Deal as another time where it was focused on just mm-hmm. a single set of decisions. Judges are appointed for life in the federal system, and so the ultimate impact of focusing on one issue when judges are deciding many, many issues over a long period of time is hopefully not that corrosive. But I do think that that happens when there's a crisis or when a particular issue is coming to a head, and hopefully that sort of dissipates over time. There aren't so many issues that get that kind of treatment.
I would just add one thing on that, which is that I wrote a piece for the Post about how the appointment of Merrick Garland may matter less than you know we think. Sort of saying, well, liberals are all excited; we're finally going to get a 5-4 liberal. Conservatives are all worried. Oh, there's finally going to be a liberal majority. But actually, when you look at how constitutional law changes. It doesn't tend to change just because of appointment of a new justice. It changes again through this much lengthier incremental democratic process. So in a way, it's a, you know, the litmus test questions are kind of mistaken, because that's not how constitutional law changes. It doesn't happen because you put a new justice. It happens because of a range of work. Merrick Garland may well be opposed to Citizens United. He may well get confirmed. They may well get that case up again. And I think there's a good chance that it will not be overturned, even though you'd now have five justices who ab initio would have wrote the other way.
Yeah, I read that op-ed piece. I thought that you were at your most law professorish in that. It was like, well, in the long run, it'll all sort itself out. If I'm the Planned Parenthood lawyer up there, and I am challenging the new restrictions in Texas and Louisiana, the appointment of Merrick Garland to replace Antonin Scalia means a hell of a lot to me, don't you think?
No, absolutely. In the short term, on specific cases, of course it does. But in the long term, look, we've had 40 years of a conservative majority court. Yeah. Miranda was not overturned. Roe versus Wade was not overturned. Affirmative action still exists. These are things that the conservatives really fought. Yes, gun rights were recognized, but not in a very fulsome way. So yes, there have been changes. I'm not saying that it doesn't matter, but the changes, again, are much more incremental over time and democratically driven as much as imposed from the top down by whoever these justices are.
I mean, and just to hear you talk about the new nomination process, aren't you a little bit sort of wimping out on your hypothesis here? I mean, here you have, you're saying it's the people's responsibility to interpret the Constitution. It's the people, you know, who and the people's representatives have a role in this. But when it comes to actually appointing the justices who will bring these, make these rights real, say, oh, we can't have any politics there.
No,
we can't. Ask them how they'll stand,
how they'll vote on these issues.
Why not?
You can ask, and then you say,
well, it's fine if they say no.
Right.
Well, I mean, what's that? I mean,
because that reflects this tension that on the one hand, we do understand we need a constitution and we need an institution that stands above ordinary politics to do the things that the democracy doesn't do well, which are many. So we need that, and we need to protect their independence. And there's a real value to the role of a judge, the obligation of a judge, the institutional design of a judge that plays a very valuable role and requires that they be above politics. And I think we all recognize that. You don't ask a judge point blank, what they're going to decide on something. They'll tell you when they write their decision. And there's a whole, the judges have to be more careful about what they say in public. And everybody understands that, right? So that's necessary. At the same time, this thing that they're interpreting, in order for it to have normative heft and in order for it to be a legitimate constraint on what we want to do as a majority at any particular time, has to be more than what it was when it was originally signed off on. And for it to have legitimacy, it's got to reflect this democratic deliberation. But as I say, I think the story I'm telling in this book is about constitutional politics, which is different from ordinary politics. And it's different in some of the ways that make me blanch at the litmus test thing.
I wanted to respond to two points. One on the judicial nomination process. It might be that this time is different and maybe unique historically because of this very long-term stability on the court. We've had this so little turnover on the court and the justices have been able to actually pursue an agenda over time in a way that earlier courts had maybe more frequent turnover, so that the significance of the one justice might be more than we've seen previously. In response to whether or not it's politics that's influencing the judge's decisions, you're telling the story of three sort of major shifts in judicial decision-making, but it might not be the Constitution that's changing, and it might be our understanding of how those constitutional values apply to our current context. It might be our understanding of the facts that change, which is another way of sort of interpreting the same changes. in which case that's much more consistent with an originalist perspective and with a sort of an evolving understanding of facts and science and who's in, and how these values will apply in our present day and age. And there's some great quotes that you pull from Justice Kennedy making exactly that, those points that that this these constitutional rise from a better informed understanding about how constitutional imperatives define liberty and remain urgent, and new insights and societal understandings can reveal how unjustified inequality in our most fundamental institutions. So a lot of this is seeing new things, understanding facts in a new light can change our interpretation of our constitutional values without changing our constitution. And one thing that would be interesting to sort of mine more is how do the justices see what they're doing? Do they think that they're changing constitutional law? Are they discovering it? So how do you approach that?
I'm sure they don't. And in fact, I was here, we did a panel here when I was writing the book where I had Evan Wolfson, who was one of the leaders of the marriage equality movement and who I feature in the book, and Dave Keene, who was a former president of the NRA. And
your book, I'm just staring at the blurbs here, has a certainly politically diverse group of endorsers. To have David Keene endorsing one of Dave your Keene. Books is kind of a delicious
it's
thing.
A, the head of the NRA said, this is the single best book about the NRA that's ever written. That's pretty good, right?
You don't want to read the other stuff that he's written, but this book, he's fine,
I hope that doesn't scare you off from reading it, but both of them sort of resisted my suggestion that they were trying to change the Constitution. And particularly within the NRA, where there's it's largely a conservative organization, largely group of people who say we're not changing constitutional law. We're just correcting a mistake. And you could say facts on the ground change, but they don't change. That's the passive voice, right? How do they change?
No,
right? How did the NRA correct this mistake? And when you look at how they did it, it was through a intensely political effort at every in every outlet that they could make headway. I think the strength of the NRA, and I think we can all learn from the NRA, is that they understand the democratic, the sort of necessity for political struggle to the realization and protection of constitutional rights. That they're not just up there, they're not just in a piece of paper, they're not just enforced by the guardians of liberty, the court. They require us to be engaged through these kinds of organizations in a whole range of strategies in order to make the thing happen.
One prism to look at your book through, another chapter you might have written, I think, was about originalism itself, which was essentially introduced into political into sort of legal political doctrine during the Reagan administration by Robert Bork from the bench, by Edwin Meese giving a series of speeches, and has been enormously successful, I think, in as a way of talking about the Constitution, if not ever commanding a full majority of the court, at least in all cases. How do you account for originalism's rise at the same time you see these movements clearly changing the Constitution also succeeding at the same time?
Yeah. Well, I think a couple of things. One is I don't think originalism, I think the influence of originalism in terms of actual decisions is not that great. In terms of the sort of academic debate and dialogue, it's taken seriously in a way that it wasn't when I was in law school, certainly. And Robert Bork was my con law professor, and even so,
fail with you?
But and I also think it's sort of inevitable that originalism will sort of die out, because it's one thing to be an originalist like Scalia and to maintain your position of originalism when you never have a virtually never have a majority of the court that agrees that that's the appropriate way, and you write dissent after dissent after dissent. But you're always looking back, and the great justices, I think, who have been in dissent and articulated a strong vision that has ultimately become sort of a leading part of our constitutional framework, like Justice Brandeis or Justice Holmes, we're prescient about looking forward. And originalists are looking back. They're looking back. So I think it's kind of inevitably going to die off. I think Scalia was a very, very powerful advocate and sort of outsized powerful advocate in terms of this concept. And even so, he could only really get Justice Thomas to go along with him in any kind of consistent way. So I don't think it's a and then the question of how did it gain its prominence? I think a lot of it is Justice Scalia, but another part of it is a civil society story. And it's told a little bit in Jane Mayer's book, and it's told in a book called The Rise of the.
Steve Tellis's book. It's basically about the Federalist Society and the intellectual.
So there was a group of people who committed citizens who saw originalism as a useful mechanism to push back against some of the rights that they didn't like that had been recognized using more living constitutionalism kinds of mechanisms. So they got behind it in the same kind of way that the NRA and the gay rights groups got behind their ideas.
But I just in terms of public arguments, one thing I was struck by during both Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan's confirmation hearings is that the questioning from the Republican senators was all based on the idea of, well, if your views are not tethered to the views of the framers, you're just making up constitutional law. And that is sort of what Justice Scalia argued and what Justice Thomas argued. But, you know, that's a big when you have convinced, you know, the core of the Republican Party that this is the correct way to interpret the Constitution, that's still pretty darn significant, I think.
No, it is. But again, with the exception of Scalia and Thomas, I don't believe there's anybody on the Supreme Court that really takes it strictly. And even they don't. I mean, even Scalia was not as strict about it as Thomas was. So, they made a lot of progress. But I just don't think, for the reason that there are many reasons to be skeptical about originalism, including, you know, how do we know what the framers thought about GPS devices and things like that, but even if we did know, who cares, right? If we, as a community, have a different set of fundamental principles and they've developed over time in an organic way, the fact that they differ, so the fact that we now think segregation is wrong, or we now think women should have equal protection, or we now think that gay people have equal dignity to straight people, you know, those are. Those are more powerful to me, and more and ought to be part of our constitutional framework. But they only they can only be part of our constitutional framework if you reject originalism, given how hard it is to amend the Constitution. I mean, Scalia's answer would be, well, if the court wasn't doing this, then we would just amend the Constitution more. You know, the last amendment to the Constitution was the 27th Amendment, and it was passed in the 80s. And it was not terribly controversial. It was that members of Congress, if they vote themselves a pay raise, should not be able to get the pay raise. It goes to the next, you know, member of Congress.
Wasn't it pending for like 100 years or something?
Years. It was introduced in like 1790 and didn't pass till 1980. So that's not a way to, you know, keep the Constitution living. So my argument is that Judge Learned Hand said, what keeps the Constitution living is us. But I particularly think, you know, it's not us in some amorphous movement sense, but it's us in the specific manifestation of organizations focused on constitutional liberties and values, people who come together because of a shared vision and then work with the resources and commitment over the long time it takes to convince, which is really what they're doing. They're convincing the people that this is a value we ought to take as our own.
And it might be just a linguistic problem here, a messaging, like the calling it constitutional change, because the values stay the same. And so at some point you're tethered to the Constitution, to the broad values of equality, due process, and then you're just changing your understanding of how they mean and how they apply to present context. So there needs to be. I think there's a lot of power in the idea of originalism when it gets sort of applied in so narrowly and so targeted towards specific questions. It, beca- it goes to the absurd, but I think if we run away from the idea that there's some sort of central values that we've had since the founding, which we've never fully realized, but that we're continuing to evolve our understanding with and struggle with, then we still are tethered to something concrete that's not just making it up.
Wendy, you said earlier in our conversation that you think Dave is right, that the let's talk about Citizens United, that it is not just a matter of litigating correctly. Yeah. It's about the larger effort.
Yep.
How's that going?
I think it's going great. I think that we are like on the precipice of some really major change, and I think we have a lot going for it, and in part because of a lot of the groundwork laid over many years by many, many people, including people at the Brennan Center and at other groups, and by the Open Society Foundations as well. But I think that, you know, fundamentally, it's persuading people, as you said, it's persuading all relevant segments of society and the profession and judiciary that this is inconsistent with our understanding of the Constitution and our constitutional values, and that I think, this is the first federal election and presidential election in decades where money and politics has taken on such a central role in the election, where there's a really such broad public consensus that Citizens United as just a placeholder for the entire money and politics jurisprudence has been wrongly decided and it needs to be changed. And where all these candidates are stepping up behind it, we're seeing activism across the country. We're seeing states pass ballot initiatives calling for resolutions to overturn Citizens United, people trying to pass other money and politics reforms. And there's really been a real increasing consensus among the elite thinkers, among academics, law professors, among other major influencers, that something's deeply wrong and that something needs to change. And one of the other, I think, things that precipitates court changes is an understanding that the decisions that they've made are unworkable or have led to maybe unintended consequences. And if there's ever an election that showed the sort of unworkability of the court's current jurisprudence and all these consequences that they said were not likely to happen, the growth of super PACs, the incredible shrinking of the number of people who are responsible for financing elections, it's this election. So I think that we are poised at a precipice where it does seem inevitable that something's going to change. And now, now there's some strategic considerations, but I think we've built a lot of the groundwork.
Well, you both alluded to the fact that one difference between the Citizens United issue and, say, the Second Amendment and marriage equality is that instead of looking for sort of the perfect case to, you know, pull the thread holds some bad law together, you are in a situation where the court has already deregulated a lot of what's going on, and there's no such thing as a court case that can restore regulations.
Right.
So how do you do what you do?
Well, I think that, there are a number of, there are still standing campaign finance regulations, and there are some that are continuing to make their way through the courts, and there's actually a case right now that implicates campaign finance jurisprudence that's right before the court involving a bribery or a corruption conviction of Governor McDonnell. So there are other opportunities, cases where the court might have an opportunity to start changing course and signaling that it's receptive to a broader set of interests and maybe pull back from some of the sort of sweeping assertions it's made. I think that ultimately there's going to be a more cataclysmic event, and the question is, what are the sort of earlier steps beforehand that sort of chip away? And I think one good example is the backlash against Roe v. Wade, where the court had recognized a strong right, and where the choice opponents have sort of very slowly chipped away at that right through smaller regulations to the point where we're now experiencing cases which are essentially completely eliminating access to abortions. That's one option. There are other options where the court, other times when the court changed course after the New Deal, after the Lochner era was a sort of another course correction where there was a right that was recognized on the other side that had been overturned. That was done in a single opinion. So there are different paths that the court could go in.
Wendy raises, I think, a very good point there, which is that yet another chapter that could have been written in this book is Roe v. Wade.
Is
the backlash to Roe v. Wade.
Yep.
Like, where do you think that struggle is? In what, and ongoing. How does that fit with your theory that Merrick Garland makes no difference?
I didn't say no difference.
All right.
Less of a difference. It totally fits within my story. I mean, in some ways, much of my story is about the importance of state forums to the development of federal constitutional law. So that's what how marriage equality was developed. That's how gun right, the notion of an individual right to bear arms, was developed. By the time the federal constitutional Second Amendment question was before the Supreme Court, the NRA had already succeeded in getting about 45 states to recognize an individual right to bear arms. So if there's already in their state law, that recognized through almost all the country, it's a lot easier for the court to recognize the federal right. And it's harder when there's been a constitutional right recognized and you're trying to chip away at it. But what have the pro-choice, pro-life people done? They have gone to the states. And the nice thing about the states is you can choose your states, right? So the gay rights groups went to Vermont and Massachusetts and Connecticut, New England, where the gun rights people inevitably start in Florida, so much so that it's called the Gunshine State. And I feature a woman in the book called Marion Hammer, first female president of the NRA, who never went to law school. She's 4'11". She's in her 70s. She carries around a pretty significant pistol in her purse. But her power is that she is the most influential lobbyist in Florida. So they start there. And then they take it and go. And the pro-life people have done the same thing, figuring out laws that you can create that sort of push at the edges of Roe versus Wade, create an opening of a broader set of understandings, for example, of the state's legitimate interests in regulating women. And that's the same thing that ultimately I think is going to happen with respect to Citizens United. There will be a broadening of the. And Wendy alluded to this, to the recognition of a broader set of legitimate interests that justify the state in restricting. It won't be to say corporations don't have rights. It won't be to say the regulation of money in campaigns is not a First Amendment issue. It will always be a First Amendment issue. But if there is a recognition of a broader set of compelling interests on the other side of the aisle, you can get to a significant amount of regulation. But that will happen, I think, largely through the states. And they're already doing it.
I think that there will also be states and more states who will want to actually act even in the face of the Supreme Court's decision. I think the dissatisfaction is so strong that there will even be defiance too, which is something that's
not to work as well. But,
no, but one of but I think that it's I don't think
you don't
it's
want to get the Supreme
stop.
Court's backup.
Yes, yeah, so this no. is not. Yeah, I don't think that this pushback against Citizens United is going to stop. I think that there's a lot of tension there. And one of the observations after reading your book that I was thinking is that this backlash might actually make whatever reform, whatever new balance comes to the Supreme Court, hopefully, if I'm correct, that we're poised for a change, the Supreme Court's going to recognize that a lot of the grounding on which it's recent. I mean, it's all fairly recent. I mean, even if the seeds were in an earlier 1974 case, they didn't really come to fruition except in the last 6-7 years. Decisions were rested on sort of factual misunderstandings and sort of a not appropriate balancing of interest. I think the new order will rest on much firmer ground because we've actually experienced the precipice already. And so it'll actually be harder to chip away in the future, I think, because people see or you could start seeing what it looks like without this regulatory scheme in place. So.
Why don't we invite our audience to ask some questions? And you have to speak into the, even though we could all hear you, you need to speak into the microphone so our friends in Washington can listen along. This gentleman on the aisle over there. Oh, I'm sorry, Steve, what did you do?
Just quickly, the time has come for me to distribute those three glasses of water. So I'm going to come up on the stage. Don't think that I'm enraged member of the Federalist Society.
We took care of it. Collaborative energy. Yes, sir.
Thank
you. I apologize for my voice, but I'll speak slowly and I'll enunciate clearly. There's a social class dimension that you haven't discussed. You go to this discussion, there are three issues that you raise. It's a discussion among the upper middle class. Yeah. The backlash is coming from the lower two-fifths of the labor force. We're with technology and social networking and all this stuff, outsourcing industry, we don't no longer need the lower two-fifths of the labor force. And they're slowly being pushed out of the body politic, voter disenfranchisement, and other things.
Okay, just ask a question, please.
You don't discuss that. And the three issues that you discussed, it's a discussion among the upper middle class. And the people, the lower working class that feels alienated, all the referendums that have
okay, been, again, I think we got the question.
Your issues.
I would push back. I certainly don't think gun rights.
What?
Turned it off. I certainly don't think gun rights is an issue of the upper middle class. The strength of the NRA lies in its members. Its members are not the elite particularly, but they've been able to mobilize that group of people behind a particular idea in a very effective way. So I don't think it's my point is about the necessity for democratic collective action to advance and protect constitutional rights. Yeah, in our society, to be sure, those who are powerful and wealthy and elite have lots of advantages. But democracy does create the possibility for collective action by a broader constituents, and it's the same it's the same mechanism. So I'm not refuting or taking on that question. I'm saying that whatever you're fighting for, it's got to be through this kind of collective action that works through civil society.
I'm for democratic collective action in favor of stuff I agree with. In the back, all the way, the gentleman there.
Do you think they're grooming Denny Chen to be a Supreme Court justice? And could you ever see a day where possibly Barack Obama would go on to the Supreme Court after the presidency?
Well, I don't know anything. I don't know about Denny Chen and Barack Obama. I
talk about a good name drop. I've asked Barack Obama that question. I interviewed him in 2014, and I actually asked him during the 2008 campaign when I thought it might be more realistic if Hillary had won to appoint him. He said he's not interested, and I really do believe that he's not interested. And as for Denny Chin, I think Denny Chin is already in his early 60s, and Merrick Garland notwithstanding. I don't think any Democratic president, other than in these very unusual circumstances of the Scalia vacancy, is going to nominate anyone in their 60s in the near future. Who's got another question? Sir, there. Yeah. Wait for the microphone.
Hi. I wrote an article in Truth Out on Citizens United and McCutcheon. Mm-hmm. And looked at the particular verbiage and also how it all relates back to Marbury versus Madison. And Jefferson very, very forcefully brought up his view that Marbury versus Madison was not at all what was intended, and the court created for itself the really troubling possibility that five unelected people acting as a faction could turn the Constitution into anything they wanted. And the idea that justices never do anything disingenuously, I think, is a fantasy.
And so what's your question?
I'm sorry. Getting back to the fact that we have now gotten to a point where a major candidate is saying this seems to be an oligarchy, and what is our road back to getting a democracy? See, in the current position that the court has redefined the system we are in, so I'd like to ask Wendy what concrete actions she sees as the most promising to overturn McCutcheon and Citizens United and bring back a truly representative one man, one vote, or one woman, one vote system. Thanks.
Thank you. I think that we have a huge number of challenges to our democracy, many of which are directly attributable to five votes on the Supreme Court, and the mess that we're in now with respect to money and politics is directly attributable to a series of about 6 or 7 5-4 decisions that really transformed the nature of politics. I think we are entering our first presidential election in 50 years without the protections of the Voting Rights Act. And one of the things that can be done and that is being done is mobilizing against this. I mean, there's a lot of popular opposition and there's to these decisions, and the electoral process is another place where expressing this kind of dissatisfaction with the direction of the country can be felt. And it's now, we need to mobilize against it. We need to clearly articulate what's wrong and what the harms are of these actions, and then put pressure on our political leaders to do something about it and change that course. And the court is one place where presidents have the power to reshape the law. The bully pulpit and regulations are another place. There, even without the court changing course, there's a lot that we can do to take back our democracy. And you know, there are a lot of policies that are even permissible under the current understanding of the Constitution that could really improve what the court has undone, whether it be public financing of elections, whether it be restoring the Voting Rights Act. There are a number of bills pending on both of these in Congress. These are actions that we can take right now to take back our democracy, even if the court doesn't change
course. The gentleman raises a sort of a profound question about the nature of the court, the place of the court in American life. It is the most counter-majoritarian, counter-democratic institution. They are unanswerable to, they have no accountability, they serve for life. Yet you assert that they are subject to democratic pressures anyway.
Right. And that's the sense in which I think this is a good story, right? Because it would be, as I said before, it would be problematic if they weren't. If they were truly independent, if they truly had the power to impose, to subvert democracy, as you say. I mean, so Thomas Jefferson said he saw that the court had the power to subvert democracy, five justices. We've now had 240 years. The court has not subverted democracy. You know, it's undermined the ability of some efforts to limit money in campaigns, and it's struck down part of the Voting Rights Act because it was out of sort of sync with where we had come. But we're still a democracy. We're still electing a president. The president will still
listen to you.
No, we are.
Listen, Dave is like, hey, what's the problem? Everything's great.
No.
And the course correct.
No,
also the message here.
What's happened to you, my God?
The way that we correct is through the democratic process. And again, the point of this book is that when you look at how constitutional law develops, it is not imposed top down from above by five people who happen to wear robes and all agree. It is built from the bottom up by us, by the people engaged.
One second. The gentleman in the back, and then I'll get you. I promise. I don't mean to be. Yeah.
Okay. I do civil rights laws. a lawyer here in New York, and from the trenches, you know, the Supreme Court takes, what, 70 or 80 cases a year, but I'm faced with U.S. district courts and the Second Circuit who routinely like to throw out civil liberties cases on you're not ripe or, you know, or it's moot or both. I've had a case where it was both moot and not ripe, or standing or judicial immunity, all these types of things. So I guess my question would be, with the Supreme Court taking so few cases, it seems to me the people's right to petition government and the judiciary's role in keeping government accountable is being diminished by the federal courts, in my view, being too conservative and too quick to throw out and not address all sorts of cases. So I was wondering if you'd have an expressive view on my view that the federal courts should be more involved in taking more cases.
Yeah, well, I think there's a access to justice problem which has many elements, one of which is a set of decisions that have made it very difficult for people to bring legitimate grievances to court. And they include the laws on arbitration, they include the laws on qualified immunity and sovereign immunity. They include laws on standing and the like. How's that going to change? By people organizing around the principle of access to justice. And, you know, to some extent they have. It hasn't been as sort of sexy a topic, really, as some of these others have been. But if it's going to change, that's why it will change.
This gentleman
and that,
here.
Too, is the product of organizing on the other side. I mean, the reason why you're faced with that doctrine and that firewall when you get into court is because of strong organizing, probably a little bit more elite organizing on the side of that disagrees with you.
This gentleman here, let just wait for the microphone.
Wait, Dave.
It's on, yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Dave, you say state forums. State forums is your proposal for the citizens in our democratic society to have their voice heard. Now, here's the question. How are these state forums going to go up against ALEC, the American Legislative Council that's funded by the Kochs?
Yeah, so...
I mean, the Kochs have their lobbyists writing the laws.
That's right. And they're engaged in state forum. They're engaged in law development at the state level. That we have to do the same thing. If we care about these sorts of issues, I think ALEC is a great example. I mean, ALEC worked with the NRA to develop model laws, pass them first in the states that were most sympathetic, and then expand them to the point where they can jump the tracks to the federal forum. This is not a recipe for progressive reform. It's an argument about how law changes, and that when the law is against you in one forum, you need to find alternative forums. If the law is against you on federal constitutional law, you either have to go to the legislature, the federal legislature, the executive branch, regulatory action. If you can't go there, then you go to the states. And I think one of the nice things about the states is that there are, you know, there's going to be some states who are going to be on your side. And you have a place to start, and then you can build momentum.
But, follow up on your question, and you can continue. I mean, I think one of the idea behind this question, perhaps, is how much of your idea behind this book is dependent on something like a fair fight. You know what I mean? It's something like, you know, both sides get to put their ideas forward, and this gentleman is saying, well, it's not a fair fight.
I guess I don't understand why it's not a fair fight. The ALEC exists. It's a conservative organization. It is devoted to reforms in a conservative direction at the state level. Lambda Legal, GLAAD, Freedom to Marry were liberal organizations devoted to developing liberal constitutional conceptions at the state level. It's an open field. We can all engage in it. And, you know, and where we see, if you're liberal and you see conservatives engaging in this action, as the NRA did, One thing you don't do is sort of sit back or focus on Washington. You have to go and fight where the fight is. And so one of the reasons the NRA was so successful is that the gun control organizations, Brady and the like, were focused in Washington. They didn't fight at the state level. Now, Bloomberg is trying to change that with his organization, and I think that's a good development. But the point is, it is an opportunity. The states are an opportunity for those who are seeking to move for change, and it's been that way forever. I mean, if you look at prohibition, if you look at women's suffrage, these things were first advanced at the state level by people picking their states wisely, and then going state to state and building momentum to get.
Yeah, but there wasn't a Koch brothers financed ally.
You know, we live in a capitalist system.
Writing the laws, their lobbies tell.
We live in a capitalist system, but we have to fight it in the ways that we can, and that's, you know, that's just the nature of the thing.
Under what constitutional right did the Supreme Court give Bush rather than Gore the presidency? Does the Constitution?
It was a one-time only equal protection right. But
let's go to the woman. Two rows behind you there. Yeah. I have a book on that if you're interested, but we can get into that another time.
So I'm really addressing this to Wendy, and to what the Brennan Center is doing. How much litigation could be based on factually showing that there can't be a firewall between a super PAC and the candidate? Sometimes I think I'm the only person who watched to the end of MIT. Because at the end, caught on film.
The end of what, I'm sorry?
MIT, the documentary.
Oh, when he irons the sleeve, that one?
Right, you know, where Karl Rove calls up and tells Mitt and Romney not to concede the election. So how much, you know, is this part of a strategy in the Brennan Center?
I think that it's incredibly important and valuable to undermine that the entire edifice of campaign finance jurisprudence rests on a series of factual assumptions, many of which, including that one, I think are incorrect, and they can be disproved. And actually, it's one of the things that we are trying to do is actually foster more scholarship and investigative journalism, actually targeting those factual assumptions that we think there's already substantial evidence aren't true, including the fact that independent spending is not really independent. They also have an assumption that independent spending cannot be corrupting and will not undermine people's faith in the access and influence that donors get, will not undermine people's faith in the fairness of their democracy. All these are sort of factual assumptions. So I think that is a critical part of a litigation strategy, building that factual record, demonstrating that these assumptions that the decisions rest on aren't true. That said, I think that the effort is greatly benefited by the at the same time a broad popular mobilization and public opinion that these decisions are wrong and they don't reflect our values. So while you need both together, I think, when you're heading into the court, that understanding that something's wrong here, this doesn't accurately reflect these values that the court is expounding and our constitutional values, our fundamental values, I think put together with that factual research, I think, makes a very powerful showing.
Final question. Who has a final question? Yes, this woman here.
Hi, I'm curious if you could speak to if you saw any differences in the national security context. I'm thinking really about sort of the difference in constituencies and who activates sort of your citizen-led momentum in the kind of cases that involve foreign policy or some of the specific loopholes to rights that we find in the national security setting.
Great, great question. So, you know, the third story is really different. So the question is, you know, how is national security different and what are the constituencies for citizen action in that context? And it's a great question. They are very different. In some ways, it was the most challenging area of all, for a couple of reasons. One is you don't have the option of state forums, right? When you're talking about the president's power to wage war, it is a federal question. Massachusetts can't really say much about it. So you lose that. Yep. Two is that most of the victims were not citizens. most of the victims of the abuses that were undertaken were foreign nationals. And so you didn't have a self-interested body of citizen constituents, particularly, to activate. So how did they, how did groups engage? One of the things they did was they recognized that, you know, there are no American citizens at Guantanamo, but there are citizens of 42 different nations at Guantanamo, and they are citizens somewhere. And in those places that they are citizens, there will be concern. And so I feature Clive Stafford Smith, who's a lawyer with Reprieve, which is located in London, not here, which represented 85 people at Guantanamo. They filed habeas petitions on behalf of all their clients. But they didn't get a single person out through a habeas petition. But what Clive also did was he took, for every case, he went to the country from which the person was. He pulled their family together, held a press conference, raised public awareness about how their people were being abused by us. That put pressure on their government, which then oftentimes put pressure on our government. And there's a particularly powerful story, I think, of the way that public opinion around the British detainees caused Tony Blair to reverse his position, which was originally, I'm 100% behind George Bush, Guantanamo's a great place, I have no concern about the British detainees there, to I demand that they be returned. And when he switched, Bush released the British detainees. And as soon as the British detainees were released, this was before the Supreme Court even heard its first argument on the Guantanamo case, they told their stories about what happened there and about the torture that they had suffered. And when the first case was heard, Guantanamo case in the Supreme Court, two of the justices asked about torture, even though the cases were not about torture. Why? Because those stories coming out of Britain had made their way across the pond and informed the concern of the court. And Paul Clement, arguing for the government, said, "Don't worry, the United States doesn't torture." And that night, CBS 60 Minutes published the Abu Ghraib photos, which were remarkably similar to the accounts that the Guantanamo detainees had given in advance of these pictures of how they were treated. And so there, one of the principal avenues for engagement was foreign citizens rather than, you know, states and U.S. citizens. And, you know, you might say, well, that's problematic. Our Constitution should be driven by our views, not by their views. But, you know, I think we should be the last to object to others calling into question our human rights record. After all, our State Department issues a report on every other nation's human rights records in order to try to change their behavior. And one of the things that I think is hopeful, one of the things that makes the war on terror different from World War II, is that there is a human rights rhetoric, there's a human rights institutional network that can speak to these issues and organize transnationally to bring pressure to bear on a country that is, as ours was, violating the rights of others.
2 points. One, Dave, Professor Cole, will be signing his book outside, so please buy multiple copies. And second, join me in thanking Dave and Wendy for
coming. Thank you.